Okay. Oh. Oh no, it's quite nice. We're supposed to get to like 60 today. Oh, look at that beautiful, kind of cool sky. It's kind of neat. Sorry.
So,
don't need to leave you hanging like that. Nothing I can think of. Not of which I can think. Have a wonderful day, gorgeous. I hope. Hope it ends up being a wonderful day. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Well, my plan is to stay late after work, you know, work on stuff. But you guys come get me when you come get me, whenever's convenient. Uh-huh. Oh. Oh. Okay, I'm on my way. See you later, gorgeous. I'm sorry, what?
You stay up there.
Yes, ma'am. Bye bye. Alrighty. I'm getting off just a little bit late. You heard all that kissing and such. That's the way it goes. Well, it's been a really interesting few days since I last made any kind of recording. The presentation I was obsessing over is done. Whatever it was designed to do, it has done. I guess. I don't know. Let's see. A lot of thoughts the last couple of days on the matter of transcendence. And, but I'm probably a bigger guy than I think. And, you know, how that ultimately manifests itself is, well, we'll just have to see. You know, I have no idea. Seems like I'm a big guy, just by nature. I don't mean just, you know, size-wise. I seem to make some pretty big things. I don't know. Well, no, I'm not sure. I'm just a big guy. And I think as time passes, it'll become more, apparent to me, I guess. Other people seem to sense it. I think it's almost kind of a visceral sort of emotional thing. I seem to exude trust and the fact that maybe big people are on the problem, stuff like that. And find out today how this job job jump went. Be going into applications as opposed to operations. And I find myself still somewhat, you know, it's an exciting change for me. I'm getting accustomed to having a whole bunch of things that frankly just really aren't my, going to be my department. At least not directly anymore. And I get emails, you know, a dozen or so every day about operations issues that I'm gonna, that I need to kind of get off of my plate so they don't come to me anymore. We got our first check from payments on the house that got that we sold in Tucumcari. That was nice, quite nice. Anyway, so that's a great, that's a good boost for our local economy right now. So hopefully our angst about not making it will kind of smooth out. At least it's going to be very studied about setting aside a lot of that money for future needs. Definitely got to build our rainy day fund back up. And, you know, saving for another mortgage at some point. Although, one of the things in the back of my mind says, our original plan was that we wouldn't be buying another house for a time. And, that may very well continue to be true. As we let things start coming together, you know, I have absolutely no clue what the future holds, except that I'm doing capacity building right now. I don't know what toward. Keeping it generalized, which, you know, I've always tended to do. Even when I was getting my certificates for computer stuff. Always tending to stay generalized, so I don't, you know, don't get compartmentalized, things like that. you think about larger. Larger needs. Always been a big picture guy, which I think came out pretty strongly in this presentation that I did last Friday, now Monday, afterward. And I got a call last night from a counselor in our state presidency wanting to talk to Lisa and I. That usually betokens a calling change. I haven't really been in Pacalis long enough in my present calling to feel like that I've really accomplished much except to try to catch up a few things. Has fallen behind. And the whole thing, but I really need to shred a lot of stuff. And holding back becomes an important and interesting thing to do. Remember distinctly getting counsel from someone and when it came time to do what was asked, had a distinct impression not to handle it in that way. You know, this is what I said, well, back in, you know, Mesa or wherever they came from, this is how we handle these things. Always a little bit reticent of doing what they did someplace else. Never been the type to try to enforce that. Much more interested in for not being a traditional person, I tend to honor other people's traditions. You know, that you aren't just some adjunct to, I'm sorry, the Utah Church. That local variation is fine, albeit you know, like I said, it's always bishops or branch presidents or stake presidents' prerogative on how things ultimately get done and the process that they want to have in place. And individual variation from whatever council is given by Salt Lake or the Brethren or whatever, it's something to be dealt with at that level. It's not for me to come around behind and say, you know, this thing or that thing is you know, you can go behind local leaders' backs to accomplish the larger goals of bigger issue. Sadly, I've done that on occasion. Typically only when I've been totally, you know, poked at by the Spirit. Otherwise, I see the value of not questioning these things too deeply, but only to mention them and say, you know, I'll do whatever you want. Thank you. it is inappropriate, you know. It comes of the concept of sustaining leaders. And you go, I sustain leaders. That's what I do. So when it comes to things like scouting, stuff like that, I was trying to think of the right way to state it earlier. It's a question of, don't have the luxury of having a particular attitude about that. That it simply is what it is. I mean, if it's, think about callings, what was the second counselor in the same presence? Of course, it just would be, it doesn't seem like it's a courtesy call. It seems more like a, calling type of circumstance. It's short. It's going to get to the point. Both me, Lisa, and I are asked to be there. I don't know if it's a Lisa calling or a Jason calling. I don't really know. Anyway, so, yeah. If it has to be something about scouts, for which Lisa's adamantly just no. And I say, well, yeah, I may not have the luxury of being able to say no. I'm obligated somewhat here. And that's always been one of the problems, is meeting that obligation. So regardless, we'll see what happens on that front. At some point, you just have to kind of put yourself out there for whatever comes along and simply deal with whatever comes along. I gotta tell you, record the fact that, usually after these presentations, no matter how good or bad they ultimately end up being, there's usually clapping involved. Whether it's just because it was gratitude for the information, or simply a courtesy. I found it very, interesting. I don't know how to interpret it, but nobody clapped at the end of my presentation. Number one, it was long. There was an option of saying that your presentation is going to take 45 minutes or 90. And when it came down to choosing the time period, something just tickled the back of the head, and I said, okay, 90. I was a little concerned that I wouldn't have enough material for 90 minutes. It turned out that I had perfectly sufficient material, and ended, 3 minutes late. It wasn't that I was not, what's the word for it? wasn't, you know, had to speed it up or slow it down any at all. It just seemed to run. I think I had in my mind that each fly would take 2 or 3 minutes. And that was kind of how I gauged it. And I noticed as I was rolling along that I think that I had severely underestimated, which I think is better. If you let people early out of a presentation, that's not the worst thing you can do. I'm a lecturer. I don't, I'm not into audience participation so much. I always think of what I do as a cousin of stand-up comedy, and therefore, you know, it's me up on stage, performing, for lack of a better word, for what I do. So, there's that. And so there's, I don't know. I do a much better job in presentations than I do on these recordings. I hope you don't listen to these recordings and think, God, he's always just wandering about. So, well, for a presentation, I do have an outline of sorts. It isn't a very extensive one. One finds themselves mostly commenting on slides, which is great for me, you know. That keeps me on topic more than anything else does. So I'm kind of a slide person. It may make this presentation seem a little choppy, but, you know, I don't memorize it. It's not like, you know, stand-up comedians do jokes and stuff like that, so it's got to be smooth to a certain level. It's not like stand-up comedy. It's like, you know, stand-up comics get a chance to do longer, presentations, for lack of a better term for it, where they are accustomed usually to having, oh, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Of material, very scripted, very polished, and some more polished than others, and I guess one finally gets to be involved with that polish once you there's a certain amount of, how do you say it, dues to pay, and you end up having to do things a certain way so that you can, you know, be part of a venue. And once you're done being a part of that venue, then you can get a little bit more flexibility. Because then it's like your brand, you know. Here comes Nemro. So Nemro can do do a lot of interesting things that most comics or performers, and it's what it ends up being, as I've always looked at it, REV, Raw Entertainment Value, that was what, to a larger extent, I offered. And started doing that early on. That was Wick. That was Wick when Raw Entertainment Value came about. So, you know, it was a question of what, what happened. It's a lot to do with just innate, whatever it is. You know, I hate to call it a skill or an ability or whatever. It's just what it is. And, I can't say I do a lot of polishing on it. This presentation was pondering, and then there was probably about 8 hours total with taking that pondering and turning it into some kind of a format outline insight thing. No, I'm not an entertainer. Never, my goal is to entertain. I see the value of being entertaining while you're doing what you're trying to accomplish. But it's always with another purpose in mind. You can't seem to access people's minds and hearts very readily unless to a certain extent you give them what they want. And as people in this time are used to being, you know, rather heavily entertained, you've got to be a bit entertaining. So, there's that. So we went and we did that. Yes, it was quite disarming that I didn't get any applause out of things, which everybody else typically does. And I don't know. I guess I've been struggling to know what exactly to do with that, how to rate that on a scale. I don't know if I blew off the scale or if I didn't even make the scale, you know? It's just, you throw yourself out there. I don't feel bad about what I did. I didn't immediately say, oh, I could have done this, and this better. It just simply is what it was. And whatever it's going to do is what it's going to do. Totally operating off of, you know, a couple of principles. That I've decided are going to be useful long term. Mostly to do with, you know, making, taking advantage of opportunities. And continuing to build on stuff that I've done before. I don't know where that eventually puts us. I was a little stressed out coming into it, but then it was like, you know, says, you need to relax, you take it easy. I says, that's probably the biggest part of the presentation, is being easygoing with it and not letting the venue and the subject matter really affect you very much. I think other people can get to that point by saying, hey, they invited me, and they want me to talk on a subject of my choice. And it's more along the lines of, you know, I guess I didn't wait to do that. Opportunity came up. It actually accepts me more on a cheap level than anywhere, any place else, for just being, you know, hey, you're going to this conference, but if you present, you don't have to pay the registration fee. And it's like, oh, okay. I think that was what put me over the edge, was my inherent cheapness in all things. I told people before I started something that I learned from general authorities about inspiration and about what you should do with inspiration. You know, it's okay if you walk out and you go someplace private to access the inspiration that you got. And it came up yesterday. So they spoke about it in passing on one of our speakers did. And made me think. Lisa was struggling mightily with the fact that failure sits in front of the church. They don't control their child very much. Or we were very much the other way, very controlling of our children. I get a lot of feedback back now that they're really well behaved and stuff like that. I credit that to Lisa. I am not the behavior maven. That's Lisa's thing. I was able to get the inspiration that I needed. But she was distracted and angry about it, and it kind of flopped over into many things. I guess I look at it more as the fact that her husband's coming out of church again. I don't know if that has anything to do with Lisa or I or anything for helping him come. Feel welcome. Feel accepted. I feel like that's one of our more, one of our larger needs. I think our, probably mine. I guess I tend to take what comes and strive to do things with it. For people, it's actually probably spend my time trying to teach better behavior. I feel there's plenty of those sorts of people engaged. That's part of what drives some people away, is the fact that, you know, there's always quite a bit of judging going on. You know, you should be out doing this instead of doing what you're doing right now, you know, type of stuff, where I don't. And I don't know if what I do is even right. It's just what I do. And I find no particular admonition not to be the way I am. So I tend to take that as it comes. Find myself, hopefully, you know, I am steered more by the spirit than I probably realize. And I find that when I just listen more to impressions that come, and don't really spend a lot of time trying to figure out, well, was that the spirit, or was that just me manufacturing it? More good comes of it. Get further ahead. You know, beyond the normal. Boy, is that going to do good? Is that going to be a good thing? One of which I usually have pretty liberal attitude about by nature anyway. So, like right now, one of my biggest concerns is I'm feeling wetness on my back, and I'm concerned that the food I put in my backpack today, that I loaded, is leaking all over my backpack and making a terrible mess. It's finally soaking through to the point where I feel it on my back. I find that if I just kind of say, you know what, I just say, just move forward. Don't spend a lot of time analyzing it, making sure it's from the right source. Take it and trust. Know that if you're going in the wrong direction, the Lord will pull you back. It isn't His job to catch you in sin. You know, and I think I operate off of a basic learned cultural response that's what you can expect from God, is that He lies in wait to catch you in sin so that He might, you know, punish you even though in this world, by and large, there's no evidence that God behaves that way. You know, much more is the lack of evidence that atheists depend on to say, oh, there is no God. Everything can easily be written off as just circumstance and just kind of the way nature works. Because I don't know where nature stops and God begins. I really don't. There are some specific examples that I can't bring to mind because of my bad memory. Where I felt like God was stirring the pot a bit. I get that impression these days. As various things happen to me, this promotion, but that I don't think ultimately it's going to be more than kind of a temporary thing. It will certainly raise the amount of money that I make and what I am able to do in the way of income. As I as circumstances take me wherever circumstances take me. Let's see, what else? What else is thought-provoking? Last week, or the last 2 weeks, have been quite eventful to my way of measuring these things. I know other people would say, well, you know, might not give it much thought. They might give it more thought. I don't know. Seems like a lot of things are stirring. A lot of activity happening. I find that true around me. I don't know why particularly that is. There always seems to be a lot of stir around me. Around actions that I take that really affect a lot of people. I find that interesting. I don't know if that's a general thing or if that's just something about me as a different sort of person. I think it was good that the Tucumcari, that we left the Tucumcari branch. It gave people there more of an opportunity to be tested, step up the plate a little bit more. You know, the fact that blessed day in the morning. I can't believe I forgot his name. Happens to me all the time. Brain farts. It's horrible. I am the most gaseous of brains. Coming slowly. Oh my. Oh, come on. It keeps popping up. Wetton. I thought of his wife first, Allison Wetton. Which is funny because Allison and I have very little to do with each other particularly. They're nice people. What wonderfully generous people. Mark Wetton. He's a branch president in Tucumcari. You know, it was something that you wouldn't have immediately thought was true. Some effort over time had been made, and some of those efforts I was involved in a little bit, to try to get them active in church. All of a sudden he's called as the branch president, I mean out of relative inactivity. He'd gotten to the point where he was paying his tithing as a response to his son being on a mission. He found that with his son on a mission, he prospered his work. He's a rancher. His work prospered amazingly while his son was on a mission. And as a result of that, I don't know, you know, I don't know where he made the connection, but he did. And I think it's the right connection. That he was grateful to the Lord, and he made that connection that it was because of his son's service that he was being blessed to be able to pay for him being on his mission. I think the rest of his family has been struggling a little bit lately. And now he, and out of what would be considered pretty much inactivity, he became the branch president. And as far as I'm aware of, it's doing quite well. He was always very reticent of his church service and how irrelevant it was and how it shouldn't be taken into account. And everybody told him that these things do come to account. He was one of our few returned missionaries. And he's a good guy. Good guy. I haven't seen him or talked to him or been in his presence at all since leaving. I'm just the type of guy that tends to run around and stay the weekend at people's houses. So, you know, my family's typically too large. It's all a sense of imposition on people, which I know I'm going to have to overcome at some point because I'm going to be imposing on people shortly. It will just simply be the way life is. And I think it's good that I have that problem because it will make me more grateful for people opening up their home to me. And letting me in, blessing their homes, whatever. Anyway, so Josh and I went home teaching last night. Got to most of our families. Ran into this lady, and I finally figured out who this lady was. I thought it was somebody else. She ends up being a person that really said, I really don't want any contact with the church. And you go, okay. I'll let people know. Not that it's going to stop anybody from making contact. I think it's good that we don't have a particular long-term system for tracking people that don't want contact. I think it's one of the places where being a little, what's a good word for it? Being a little slothful kind of works in the favor of those people. you know, you can tell a couple of people. Well, she expressed to me a desire not to be contacted. But that just the normal course of things and just, quote, bad record keeping, which I kind of put down to things that we choose not to track. These become opportunities in the future. God's work with us is sometimes quite spotty in that if you're not ready at one point, we don't close the door and walk away and say, well, never again. It's always going to be more along the lines of it's going to happen occasionally, and it's there to tickle you. The Lord is going to do what He can to your heart various times. Sometimes it's not the right time and you're not the right person. And, one can't get weird about that. We'd like to think that we were God's gift to everybody, and we're not. But regardless, we marked by the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses. Just learning today that a lot of churches expend effort in trying to make sure that one is to make sure that one is inoculated against Mormonism. So we had some cases of that. Remember my friend Jeff Chavis, in respect for his grandmother, and warnings by his local parish priest that he would go to hell if he did any such thing. After some years, he got to the point where I think those kinds of things don't worry him as much. And that, I don't think I ever saw the process, you know. I think that we just enter in at certain points and other things kind of occur over time to make us into the people that are ready to accept these things, even when we're told by people we trust and love and want to respect, you know, swear up and down that they'll disown us if we do any such thing. I am not a proponent, particularly, see, this is funny, because earlier on, about of traditionalism, because early on I was talking about how my tendency is to not change things unless there's a pressing need to do so. I'm not a person just to shake things up for the interesting side of shaking things up. That's not interesting to me particularly. I would have to have other things to persuade me that's what needs to happen. and that, I don't know, I guess, you know, it's a bit about the transcendence and about being a worker on a different realm. And that what I do for work is simply that, you know, I don't think it particularly defines me. Making this presentation was perhaps an interesting, turned out to be an interesting stab at probably working two or three levels above my pay grade, you know. I shouldn't be thinking about these things. These are the kinds of thoughts that higher level people have, and they get to speak this way and have these thoughts. I was telling Lisa Saturday morning, our normal Saturday morning sleep-in. It's not really a sleep-in. It's more of a... Jason unloads. Well, Lisa does too. Not as much as I do, of course. But, talking about my... my pay and or status work-wise being a little non-commissioned to me, to the way I tend to be, to the way I tend to think, to the way I tend to conceptualize things. And that this could be at the root of discontent. I see discontent as an indicator that something that should be happening isn't happening. That was one of the reasons why we left Tucum Carry, was because I needed to work on something that I think needed me to leave Tucum Carry, just period. And I'm very much, I found the whole concept kind of interesting and fascinating. Because you're often told, well, you need to learn how to be content with what you have. And I can't say that I disagree with that concept in general. That these are things that... that one needs to do. You know, there's a concept of self-medicating. I think far too many people do that, you know, drinking or taking drugs or whatever, trying to handle their bodies. Now, I'm not trying to denigrate those who choose to do that, you know, bipolar people. Shana medicates under quasi-doctor supervision, which is next to none. I find the whole concept a little weird. Regardless. And that we can make a choice that way. And I find myself making the choice to let discontent motivate me. That's what got me to the point to where I'm taking my degree, getting a master's. Got me to the point to where I started thinking about moving, and I started working on it, and Lisa getting to that point as well. That was probably the longest stretch, was getting Lisa to that point. She is I think Nestor doesn't quite do it justice. I think she's definitely a person that does not want to be moved. And to a certain extent, you know, she's always going to resist the whole idea of picking up and going somewhere. Of course, she's very willing to follow me and what I need to be doing. I think she feels a little guilty because for the longest time I've been letting her wishes and her desires kind of rule the day. As to where we are and what opportunities we take advantage of, and so I don't know. So now I'm kind of working on my stuff, and I anticipate to a certain extent that Lisa might have to just take what comes. This is a difficult thing for her on a larger level. Because, and she's also accustomed to getting away. And it's always going to be somewhat that way. I'll always be heavily concerned about how she's feeling and how things are going. But, I'm sorry, there's probably bigger fish to fry here. And, I've got to do what, I've got to do my job. In the larger sense of it, too. But it really does end up being, I remember going to a presentation here at Eastern, at the college here. They had brought this guy in. He had come to speak to the College of Ed, of which I was ostensibly really not a member at all. And then there was a dinner afterwards, and Lisa brought this up. Not that I had forgotten it, but she brought it up around the same time that I was thinking about it. That decidedly indicates something meaningful to me, is when Lisa sees it too. I had gone to his presentation, just one of the people in general. I was just a spectator. I don't recall having any interchange with him at all. And then he went to, and then I decided that we would go to this dinner that was being thrown. I didn't know that it was not formal, but it was certainly a dressed up sort of an affair. And I went in shorts and a t-shirt, probably a pretty ratty t-shirt. And the interesting thing, and nobody told anybody where to sit, so I just sat down at the most convenient spot. It happened to be the head table. And when it came down to the dinner beginning, you know, nobody had a respectful way, I guess, or a appropriate way to get rid, to tell us to get lost. I ended up sitting right across from this speaker. I seem to recall vaguely that he was definitely a philosophical sort, which I'm a philosophical sort, and the connections were interesting. And one of his kind of opening statements was the whole concept that he was working as, he had finished up his PhD, but he wasn't really telling you what his PhD was in, and his assertion was that nobody cared, it didn't matter. Which actually ended up, I think, being true. I didn't really care what his PhD was in. Afterwards, so anyway, that was in the presentation before to the College of Education, mostly the students. And he was talking about how education should probably make some changes to become more relevant. Of course, it's interesting, this was back in the 80s. I think the need to do something has become far more poignant over time, but, you know, we'll see what happens. Anyway, this is my first time, so I really liked him, and I said, well, at least let's go to this thing. You know, people are invited. And so I end up sitting at the head table. I think the college president, indignantly, I think he gave me a couple of glances just to be kind of indignant about the fact that I was present in the first place. Lisa was at least in jeans. I was in shorts, as I recall. Or certainly nothing considered to be an appropriate dress for the setting. I didn't know any better. We got there a little bit early before other people showed up. And the actual speaker, the man of honor, chose. You always have to remember that when you are the first one to sit down, whoever sits with you is doing so because they choose to. People often talk about, you know, oh, whose table is this? And you have to say, well, you have to understand the first person who sits there defines the table. You know? People who come later come because, on some level, you're there, or those are the available seats, one or the other. And so this guy chose to sit just right across from us. And we had a pretty lively discussion of many topics, and actually got to religion. And he said, hey, I have spoken at one of your state conferences. I said, really? He says, yeah, I'm not a Mormon. I said, well, that's interesting. So I'm sure that doesn't happen very often. You know, he said, well, I'm sure that happens. I said, no, actually, that's not a common occurrence at all. So, and we had this interesting conversation. I don't remember what the conversation was really about outside that one little snippet about conference. It was just, I guess, if you were to characterize it as an outside observer, which I was not in that case, it was just dinner conversation among equals. And I found that whole incident just bizarre on a whole level. And it's one of the things that kind of informs the whole thing of that I'm probably a much bigger fish in a pond than I think. You know, I think the term I used was a whale. I seem to be a whale in a pond. And the fact that I'm not threatening makes everybody feel a lot better. there's no really particular need to be threatening. You know, there are certain aspects of physics that are just true, and that I don't think you have to be grasping or fighting or conniving to get to that level where you're supposed to be. You know, you mostly have to overcome your personal, at least in my case, it's been overcoming my personal fear or my, what do you call it, rationalization for being a small person, of which I'm not. I'm not a small person. And as time goes by, I realize that. I'm actually quite a big person. And not just physically. I, you know, it tends to be a kind of a gravitas thing. I was over at my dad's house a couple of years ago, and one of his friends, I think it was somebody who was doing some cabinet work for him, but dad's always friends with everybody. Dude, my father's a social climber to a certain extent. He likes being around notable people. He took some art classes with Del Parsons, who is quite a noted painter. He's done whole studies on Christ that the church has acquired, and that's in the church you see quite often Del Parsons' artwork. Church bought a lot of it. And Dad just gets a kick out of taking a picture with him. You know, say, look who I'm beside, type of thing. And I have never been that sort. Probably because I'm not, I don't know, perhaps I'm not appropriately impressed by fame. I think my dad is very impressed by fame. You know. I mean, we all do the sour grapes thing, sure, where it's like, well, you know, he's this person. I could have been that if things would have gone my way. And, you know, you really can't say, particularly, how things are supposed to go. Anyway, I think my dad wants me to be a bigger person than I am, a greater person than I am. Probably sees that potential in me. Because I think he wants to say, hey, that's my son. That's my child. You know. Wants to have a connection with greatness. Yeah, I'm not doing the things I'm doing for to achieve greatness. Although I won't be surprised if that ultimately comes to pass. It seems consistent with how things are kind of going and whatever. So I find that whole thing interesting. It seems like a lot of people around me have conceptions that I'm going to be a bigger person than I am. They seem to sense it. Some people even express make expressions that actually say things along those lines. I always try, because I don't want to fall into the trap that often happens, that big people start to kind of classify themselves. There's a documentary movie called The American Ruling Class. And it's all about being in the right groups, going to the right parties, meeting the right people. One of the statements made is you need to, don't disdain for people that can't help you, that aren't above you, and constantly seeking out those people who are greater than you are. And I think those are tactics used by class-based families, people, societies, in order to that somehow intelligence and merit got them to where they are, and that that these things are by their nature supposed to be hidden from the lower classes so that they don't accidentally rise to power. Perhaps why I'm in the United States is because the elite is somewhat open and how one rises to it is not clearly defined. It has something to do with money, honestly. It has more to do with money than what family you were born into. Just listening to a hardcore history, Dan Carlin, and he alludes to the fact that the family-based status that wraps itself in monarchy and certain power structures of the old world, America and the French Revolution, democracy perhaps in general, has made some blows to it. It's certainly not gone, it's not dead, but what's left is probably just relegated throwbacks to earlier times. When I think about Shetland, for instance, I wonder sometimes what the appeal is to it to me. And I thought on occasion that the thought, I've looked at pieces of property there. They actually sell large tracts upon which many people pay rent. It's very much a rent society as opposed to a straight ownership society. Although their rentals tend to be hereditary, you could treat them like property. They certainly view it as property. Crossing laws have changed to the point to where even though you technically have a landlord, you know, it's not so much a, it's not the landlord in the sense that there is landlords in the United States to actually own the place, and the primary behavior towards renting is that it's temporary, and the landlord exercises large control over your use of it because it's temporary. They will most likely be having to rent or lease it to somebody else in the future, and your responsibility is basically not to tear the place up. Where that's a different philosophy over there, because it feels more like the ownership that we're accustomed to here. It gives more of that feel, although you're still making the payments, you know, often annually, to the landlord. And it just ends up being, for that person, an investment. It is, you know, it is not simply, you know, you have land and you make rents off the land. It also has to do with status and power and things like that. There are certain circles in which you cannot readily enter or be a part of or be respected in unless you have these sorts of circumstances. I thought sometimes about the whole landed gentry concept and how that might still make itself manifest in a place like Shemin. They certainly appreciate a landlord who is actively involved in his holdings. Not to the domination of it, but to trying to make the circumstances work better for his tenants. And I always thought that that was an interesting concept of stewardship and godhood. That's interesting. I think the British model of tenancy, I don't know if it's crossing specifically, but tenancy, probably is closer to the way that God views it, as giving you a world that has everything in it that's needed, and that your basic status is wrapped up in your management of it. Eternal life is a concept of how good of a tenant have you been, and what more are you going to be given by your landlord, by the Lord, as you prove yourself competent, worthy, willing to be taught with small things given to you, he will give you great things. You will become a god yourself and have worlds of your own that you have constructed, that you have learned how to construct, and that this is somewhat privileged knowledge that only a certain class will get. To be honest, I think God... I think God... engages in a concept of class, and I think it's where comes the concept of kings and how good kings are, can be, how much wonderful, greater influence they can have over their people, but that having a bad king creates a larger problem. His preference is that we all govern ourselves. And that that would be the ultimately the best solution to the to things. So that's kind of an interesting concept that I've dealt with over time, although it comes to mind now under interesting circumstances. I think circumstances in the future will likely return us to that, those kinds of structures. We see some of the fallacies of democracy among the evil, growing evil, and it makes it so that we are, we're just not capable of doing good, you know. The fact that we don't fight these tendencies is a bad indicator. Anyway, so, we'll see what that all comes to, see where things like this go. And we'll go from there.